Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on the Twitters, and of course, RedState.com over in the VIP section. Great content going on over there. But first, Andrew, I think we got to talk about this little brouhaha that that started up after our last podcast called the Israeli-Iranian War.
Yeah, really. It's impressive. Of course, my sympathies are not with Tehran, but
right, same here.
But when you watch time after time after time, what the Israelis and their secret services have been able to pull off, and their bravery and dedication of the individual soldiers, it's very impressive. I was taken, about 15 years ago, or maybe not that much, with the whole Stuxnet controversy. Remember that?
Oh yeah. That was a pretty big deal for Israel too, up against Iran.
And just a little back info on that. In 2001, the West promised Muammar Gaddafi that if he gave up his nuclear program, they would, leave him alone. So he did. And then, of course, 10 years later, they made sure that the crowd tore him apart fatally. But it turns out his nuclear program used the same equipment as Iran. And so they were able, the U.S. and Israel were able to reverse engineer. And that's how they planted all those malicious bugs inside, where they could listen to people at the laptop. And my favorite part of it was when they set off all the centrifuges to whirl themselves into shattered oblivion at high speed, but they had muted all the alarm signals. So the engineers are sitting blithely in the room monitoring everything going fine while the equipment destroys itself. I mean, that just shows the cleverness. I am hopeful that the U.S. has some secret things going on in its espionage programs. We usually only hear about China and North Korea penetrating so easily our infrastructure and government programs. So it's really encouraging last year to hear about the Israelis and their pager, their little pager bombs. I mean,
I called it Operation Grim Beeper. Operation Grim Beeper, which is,
that's an early joke today, Ed. Yeah, that took 2 years. It was 2 years, not just the imagination and the skills to pull it off, but the ability to keep your mouth shut for 2 years. I mean, it's just something that I wouldn't imagine was able to happen in Washington. So if, as many suspect, the U.S. and Trump and Marco Rubio did head fakes about urging Israel to be, more moderate, and geez, don't bother attacking them now. And then they actually provided intelligence on where some of these people were. But imagine setting up drone bases in your adversary with thousands of drones or hundreds of drones.
Yeah.
And you have, what do they call them? Moles inside Iranian military services who can track exactly where all these dozen formerly alive military commanders were at the very moment that they wanted to attack. I mean, the whole thing is just amazing. It happens to fit in with protecting the West and the U.S.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing that Donald Trump was saying, too, is that, you know, people were saying he's getting some criticism from sort of the fringy right about getting involved in this and being led by the nose by Israel and saying that a war with Iran is not an America. It's not an America first interest. And Donald Trump told The Atlantic, I decide what America first means. And Iran with a nuclear weapon is a threat to the national security of the United States. And we're just
everyone. Of everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. So, I mean, this is coming up today because first off, over the weekend, Israel started flying daylight sorties over Tehran, which is an incredible humiliation for the regime, right? They've managed to now knock out the top level of the entire military and intelligence apparatuses in Iran. And they're going down to like the second and third level right now. And you're getting like the, you know, the Frosh Soft team coming up to the top levels now. Not that, you know, not that they may be talented people, but they haven't worked together. I mean, this is making an inefficient, I just got done writing this lengthy piece, right? Because the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, especially, right? It's like, they're like, how did this happen? Iran was such a powerful country. And I'm here to tell you that I'm not sure why anybody actually assumed that. First off, they really didn't have much of an air force, even when it worked, right? They had a bunch of leftover stuff from the Shah and nobody sold them anything else. I think the Russians sold them some old MiGs, right? So they had some
And Putin sold them some allegedly high-tech air defense systems, which are now...
Well, they were actually, I mean, this is part of what's wrong with Russia, too, is that when you have a country that has no way to impose accountability for incompetence, where the measure of the merit, if you will, of moving up in military and political ranks is your level of loyalty to the dear leader, you're going to end up with really lousy. I mean, you might luck into having some competent people in those positions, but overall, it's going to be an absolute. Well, I can't say that word even on a podcast, but it's a poop show. It's going to be an absolute poop show.
And Putin experienced that with his intelligence services telling, oh no, Ukraine will fold in a couple of days.
I mean, actually, in my post, I make the point, right? Because the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times took the thing was, how could Iran be as bad as this after all these, you know, decades of dominance? And the reason why is because nobody challenged Iran. They put proxies out in front and stuck Bashar Assad up, you know, to keep people from directly challenging him. Once you removed all those defenses, which is what Yahya Sinwar managed to do for them with the October 7th attacks, once you get rid of all that, these are the same morons that botched the Iran-Iraq war for 8 years, right? They're not very bright. They're not very good at what they do, which is why they need a nuke. That's why they need nukes. If they were good at what they did, they wouldn't need them. They might still want them, but they wouldn't absolutely have to have them.
That's a very good point, Edward.
It's insane how people thought this. And so the Wall Street Journal took it a different way, saying, wow, Israel's accomplished what Russia couldn't, you know, Israel accomplished in 3 days what Russia couldn't do in 3 years with Ukraine. Well, yeah, first off, let me just say, even for an outfit as, you know, top tier as Israel, that's an amazing accomplishment. They surprised themselves at how quickly they were able to just absolutely defenestrate the Iranian air defenses and get air supremacy over Iran, including its capital, so much so that they can run daytime sorties over it. I mean, that's kind of a big deal.
Wasn't it last year they had a bomb planted in a room where one of the Hamas guys was going to be.
Yeah, and they were just waiting for him to show up so they could trigger it. Yeah. And then they almost didn't do it. They almost didn't do it because, of course, you know, we were trying to talk them out of it, apparently, which is part of the problem, right?
Anyway, the reason why Putin.
One quick point. What's impressive is the security, or the, what's the word? The spoken discipline of the Trump forces.
OPSEC. I would call it operational security. Yeah, the OPSEC was actually really good here, surprisingly so.
Yeah. And I guess it was helped by the fact that they did notify Congress, as I guess they're supposed to do, which is, you know, it's like pouring.
The Gang of Eight.
Yeah.
They probably notified the Gang of Eight and nobody else, which is, you know, Hakeem Jeffries, Mike Johnson, John Thune, Chuck Schumer, and then the heads and ranking members of the two Intel committees in the House and Senate.
Yeah.
So that was probably as far as it went. And usually the Gang of Eight is pretty good at keeping secrets. It's when it leaks out to the rest of the Congress that stuff goes sideways. But you're exactly right.
Yeah, it is truly amazing. And the result helps us and me. I mean, I don't want to see a nuclear cloud over anywhere, but especially U.S. or Mideast or our allies. It's truly an amazing accomplishment, and hats off to them. And for all we know, there's even better stuff that they're doing now. It is a democracy, Israel, as is ours. What impressed me is that the ability, although the media likes to write how much political trouble Netanyahu is in, but the ability to say, you know what, this is it. This is another Holocaust. October 7th was, and it's not going to happen again. We're going to finish it this time. We're not going to just stop it. We're going to finish it. And he's done it. So hats off to him. They've lived under threats. Netanyahu lost his brother in the Entebbe raid. I'm atypically speechless with the superlatives that come to mind.
Well, okay. So, and again, I mean, the difference here is that Iran was really just a paper tiger. Always has been. Now, they're very good at internal suppression because that's easy to do. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to actually project power. Now, they were smart to a certain extent by projecting it through proxies. But even then, the proxies were basically morons. I mean, so Hezbollah has been around for 40 years, right? Since 82, really, 44 years. 43 years, something like that. And the Iran formed Hezbollah within like 2 or 3 years after the revolution in Iran, right? The mullahs wanted to project power. So they formed Hezbollah, and then Hezbollah took the field in the Israel-Lebanon war in 1982. And that's where, of course, the U.S. Marines were killed in Beirut, you know, because Hezbollah bombing of the barracks. And Israel and Hezbollah have fought wars a couple of times. I think the latest one prior to the October 7th one was maybe 20 years ago, right? But they didn't fight it for long. They would fight it for a short period of time, then Hezbollah would want to would demand, you know, ceasefire negotiations. And this is what they did. This is the game they played. And the West would say, oh, yes, let's have ceasefire negotiations. And they would force Israel to stop. And Israel would stop. But this is exactly what happened with Hezbollah too, right? You had finally Israel decided, we're done with this. We're not playing this, you know, slap fight for a little bit. Then we cut a deal. We're going to take care of this thing. So once they decided to actually go to war with Hezbollah.
Morris. You're on fire today, Morris.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Once they decided to actually deal with Hezbollah, and it was actually quite a ways into the post October 7th period. I think it was September of last year, really, before they started doing anything about it. What did they do? Well, they've been busy infiltrating Hezbollah's, you know, supply cycle and planting all these, you know, pager bombs on everybody. And they made a phone call and they took out, I don't know, 70% of the leadership.
And even more importantly, they got people thinking two times about answering the phone.
Well, right, exactly. And the reason why Hezbollah was using pagers is because Israel had infiltrated their previous comms, right? And so they were using pagers because they needed some sort of low-tech way of contacting each other.
Yeah.
But I mean, they followed that up. They triggered the pager bombs, and then they followed that up by killing Nasrallah, going right after the head of the snake, and then taking out all the financial institutions in Beirut that were supplying them with cash, right, and laundering their money. And by doing that, they weakened Hezbollah so badly that it could no longer defend Bashar al-Assad, and suddenly he's gone, right? And Hamas is isolated now. So all the proxies collapsed because, frankly, they were being run by morons. Yahya Sinwar was an idiot. Ismail Haniyeh was an idiot. They kept trying to provoke Israel into a war that they couldn't win. And they did it one time too often. They did it so badly this last time with the October 7th atrocities that Israel had to completely change their mind about how to deal with this thing, and that they just simply weren't going to do antagonistic coexistence with these people anymore. They're going to actually have to destroy them. And that's what's happening in Iran right now. And that's the reason why Netanyahu is telling ABC News this afternoon, you know, we're not going to negotiate any longer. Time for negotiations over. These guys are never going to negotiate in good faith. So there's no point in it. Now, Donald Trump is saying, well, you know, if Iran makes a good enough offer, maybe we'll listen to it. But at the same time, he's bringing in a whole bunch of refueders, and the IDF is loading bunker busters on their F-35s. There's a picture that went up a few minutes ago on Twitter. They're going to try to take out Fordo without the U.S. having to be too involved in it. I don't know if they're going to succeed at that, but this is not the time for talks.
Why does Israel need U.S. tankers? So U.S. tankers are for U.S. plane.
F-35 is a U.S. plane. We sold them the F-35s, and they work with the F-35s.
So wait a minute. So we're going to fly refueling planes for Israelis to refuel?
Let me put it this way. We are going to have more capability to do that now if we choose to do it. They're ostensibly moving these planes to the European theater because there's exercises that are ongoing right now with NATO. But those exercises have been going on for, I want to say, close to 2 weeks, and they're almost over. So it's a little late in the game to truck all these things over. And what they're saying is, well, we're also demonstrating the ability to move fast and to, logistics, and that's fine and good. It's probably a good exercise of that as well. But I mean, it's pretty clear. And Donald Trump said today at the G7, we're just making sure we have all of our options on the table. So if they need more refueling in the air, they can. But generally speaking, I think that the Israelis have been handling it so far, right?
Yeah, it was 1,300, the farthest corner of Iran was 1,300 kilometers. That's a fur piece.
Well, and again, I mean, the platforms that we've sold them, the F-35 is a fairly new platform, and these things have a lot of range and they can carry a lot of ordnance. They can't carry the heaviest bunker busters. That requires a bomber. I don't think the Israelis have it.
I don't think anybody has it except the B-2s and Diego Garcia.
I think the B-52s could do it, but you need the refueling. If you're going to fly B-52s out of Diego Garcia, you have to have those refueling tankers. So that's another reason why you have those in the region. The B-2s could make that without refueling. The B-52s can't. And they're also, you can spot the B-52s on radar. The thing is at this point now, there isn't really any anti-aircraft risk to speak of over Iran because the Israelis have taken them all out. And And here's the other part of this too. We're talking about Russia. Iran is Russia's main source for drones right now. Russia isn't really produced. They produce some of their own drones.
That's right.
And what have the Israelis? What have the Israelis been destroying? They've been destroying all these production facilities for drones because the Iranians, you know, started to fly drone missions against Israel. So they're destroying all these things. And even if they're still able to produce drones, I have a sneaking suspicion that the mullahs really aren't going to be interested in selling them to Putin for a while because they're going to need them for themselves. And so Putin's in there trying to get Trump to intervene. And Trump's like, yeah, no, I'm good.
We're fine.
Yeah, well, we're good.
Well, we'll talk with them sometime. You know, and it's, you think about, just, you probably wrote this in your piece, which I can't wait to read, but you think about the planning that went into the espionage and planning that went into this raid, which obviously is not something you come up with on a weekend. To have those so many drones smuggled into Iran, stacked, you have the people to run them, the moles, you've wiped out some of the nuclear scientists already, and then you get some more. The intelligence operations of that. I read a couple of books on Mossad, and they're really, you don't want to mess with those guys, which is great. I mean, that's the way it should be. And I've thought that, well, we have different values maybe, but I've thought that sometimes I wish we were a little bit more ruthless about our enemies, but we haven't gone through a Holocaust yet. So we're not as...
We had a little bit of that focus after 9/11, and we kind of lost it. And we can argue about whether or not the Iraq war, the 2003 Iraq war, was part of that. But I think we would have lost it anyway. I think we would have. We're Americans. We don't like to think about those types of things.
And we don't have the millennial memory, of the persecutions and the devastation that come that have come to Jews, and it's our institutions, I don't know how to describe this, but our institutions have in the past, until Trump came along, seemed a little too queasy about doing apocalyptic things that might need doing to save real apocalyptic things later down the road, you know? You remember in the Iraq War, I read some history about it. Some of the Iraqi commanders of tank forces and bases, air bases and military bases, they got phone calls in Arabic from Americans or allies saying, you know, we're coming tomorrow and you've seen what we can do to your forces. So if you wanted to just, you know, pack up and leave town and tell your guys they could leave, feel free, because otherwise you're dead. And you think about the skill and the planning involved in getting the cell phones numbers of individual Iraqi military commanders so that you could, in advance, so that you could do that. It's impressive.
Well, it is. And in part because they probably had some of that because the U.S. was working with the Iraq army, or at least, you know, coordinating with them during the Iran-Iraq war period from 1980 to 1988, because they were fighting Iran. And, you know, so we probably had some, you know, we didn't really get crosswise with them, with Saddam Hussein, until it was less than 2 years. Well, maybe it was just a little over 2 years after the end of the Iran-Iraq war that Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And so we had sold him materials. We had, he was at least in part a client state. He's mostly a client state of the Soviets, but he was a, at least in part a client state of the Americans too. And that's the reason why that's the reason why things broke down so badly, is because he just made some assumptions about us and we didn't clarify things properly for him prior to invading Kuwait. Could have maybe avoided that whole thing if we had just told him up front, you cross that border and we're going to kick your ass right back out. And he might have listened. Maybe. That's the theory anyway. But yeah, I'm not sure if that's really, if he really would have listened to us, but we didn't say that to him. And so he just assumed that we were, well, the Americans don't care about Kuwait. And you know, 35 years later, here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a, the whole thing is fascinating. And so I got to go now, Ed. I'm going to go read your post.
Well, it's not up yet, so you can't leave.
Oh, come on.
In fact, we're going to talk about your column, your VIP column, absent any new leaders or ideas, flailing Democrats grasp at a favorite theme. No kings? is that the theme?
That is so pathetic. Remember when it wasn't the State of the Union, but when Trump addressed the joint session last winter after he took office?
Yes.
And Tlaib and all those others sat there with little old lady fan signs holding up about dictator and all that signs in during the joint session. It's just so pathetic. Now, you know, I, with all the caveats, don't get too cocky. Don't celebrate for too long, because American political parties have a history of morphing. That's what's kept them alive. And the Democrats are the oldest ones. So they'll be back. Remember, however, that when the Republicans got schnockered in 1964 with Barry Goldwater and Lyndon Johnson, at the time was, I think, the worst or the second worst political thumping in a presidential election. Just 2 years later, the Republicans in 1966 took eight new governorships and a whole bunch of Senate and House seats. So it doesn't take long. That's a long time ago. But and then in 1988, Republicans won the first of five out of the next six presidential elections. So they have a history of parties of bouncing back, and the Democrats have a history of clinging to losing causes for too long. If I did see, I have to go back to the column, but before and during this and after the Civil War, Democrats, you know, they were supporting slavery and the Klan. And Republicans from, let's see, 1860 to, I forgot what, 1928, they won like 16 presidential elections, and only Democrats were elected only twice. So,
right. And one of those was a split because Teddy Roosevelt broke away and
that's
ran
right.
under Bull Moose. Yeah. And that's how Woodrow Wilson got elected. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And and the other Democrat was Grover Cleveland, who's the first guy to win two non-consecutive presidential terms. So
that's why history is it's so
fascinating. Yeah, it's just
balanced.
The whole thing is so fascinating.
But you know what? You know, and here's the thing that is kind of amazing to me, Andrew, and maybe your column or our future column will address this, which is that the reason why parties adjust is because they respond to incentives, right? They respond to incentives from the voters, right? When you find yourself on the 20% of an 80-20 question, like deporting criminal illegal aliens, generally speaking, you start moving towards the 80% and you try to just come up with different solutions for the same, you know, different policies that will achieve the same result, right?
Yeah.
They're digging in on the 20%, right? The, you know, Donald Trump wants to deport wants to enforce federal law in Los Angeles, and Democrats go off and run out and have a No Kings rally. And there was a tweet, and I know that you know this because you're the prince of Twitter. And I,
oh yeah, that's like, right. Don't you forget it.
It's like, no kings, but you have to wear a mask. No kings, but you must accept the vaccine. No kings, except you have to stand 6 feet apart from everybody else. No kings, but you can't surf during COVID. I mean, which is, you know, it's an interesting branding, right? I'm not saying it won't be effective, but honestly, this whole authoritarianism thing is not a really good fit for Democrats, because authoritarianism is their thing. And
yeah.
They're just not responding to the incentives. They keep trying to really kind of force their viewpoint on people who have clearly rejected it. And that, I mean, and I think, guess that they're waiting around for Trump to screw up, and so they can just take advantage of whatever.
And he may do it. You know, I mean, history says he may do that. But I think the Democrats' problem this time, it's unique, and it's unique in the sense that they have allowed themselves, well, they have allowed Donald Trump to live in their head. He inhabits the minds of Democrats. And so their hatred of him, and that's what it is, it's hatred, is colors their perceptions and their interpretations, and they're, it's like wearing anti-Trump glasses. They can only see that, and they don't see that the reason Trump won was he was saying things that American people, and now he's doing them, were in favor of. Now they'll get over it with, and you know, I prefer Republicans, but the reality is that a properly functioning democracy does need counterbalancing forces. We do need two parties. We've had them at times. Each party has gone through times of trouble, and they come back. And these incidences with Trump in Los Angeles, I mean, if you want to have a fight with Donald Trump, picking, as you say, picking the 80%, we're against 80%, and flopping it down in California, they may, I'm not making predictions, but this may hurt California Democratic dominance. You would like to think so. There have been times where Republicans were vibrant there, not for a long time, but this silliness, that may be why they wanted so many illegals, and why they're sticking up for them, is because they know that out of gratitude, they will support Democrats forever.
Well, yes. And again, it's something is broken on the Democrat side that they're not responding to these incentives. Yeah. And I think it's because the money has really gotten hold of that party, and you don't have people who are willing to break the party free of it. Now, you had Randy Weingarten quit. Yeah, David Hogg quit. So maybe the DNC I'm talking about, maybe we might be seeing a shed the radicals movement in the DNC, except that I think that David Hogg left because of the radicals, right? He was a white guy. And so they couldn't abide him being there. So they voted him out. They voted him off the island. Now, Randy Weingarten's leaving, I think, might be it's wait and see, but we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, I mean, I think that they're just so locked into this radical extremist money that they're getting, that they don't feel like they can move off of those positions. And, you know, that, I guess that's another set of incentives, but it's not voter incentives. And that's
that's right.
That's really what they should be responding to. Yeah, you know, Trump responded to it. The Republicans responded to it. The Republicans became a lot more populist because the party, the voters became a lot more populist. And so they shifted to populism. Now, you can not like populism. I think it can be dangerous. But in truth, that's where the voters were. They were sick and tired of being lied to. They were sick and tired of having their communities gutted because of, you know, supposedly free trade that wasn't actually fair trade. you know, they were sick and tired of getting the losing end of globalization. And they were sick and tired of the institutions that were lying to them, misrepresenting, taking their money and giving nothing back. And Trump and the Republican Party responded to that. Now, whether or not that's a continuing thing is, you know, something we'll have to wait and see. And it depends on how good Trump can address some of these concerns in his second term. But at least they're responding to it.
Exactly. And how good Trump can hand off the baton when he's done. You know, we're taping this on Monday. It was exactly 10 years ago today that he came down that escalator.
That's right.
And began to radically change American politics. And it's always amazed me, and always will, that of 17 Republican candidates in the 2015-16 primary season, Trump, the billionaire who lived on Fifth Avenue, was the only one who heard the anger and frustration that you just described in the heartland, tapped into it, voiced it, promised to do something about it, and then, unlike all the others in the too comfortable political establishments of both parties in Washington, Trump actually fulfilled his campaign promises, and he's doing it again. Imagine that, and keeping a promise. People go, holy smokes, I like this. I don't like some of the things he says and does, but by golly, I like what he's doing.
Well, you know, integrity will take you a long way, right? And following up on what you promised to do is a measure of integrity. And yes, that's the reason why he's popular. He's going to, he's more popular than he's ever been. Let's just put it this way. He is right now more popular than he's ever been. And that is going to continue to increase, especially if Democrats keep rejecting what voters are telling him about things like immigration and trade and the rest of it. So, and deportations. So,
And as long as Republicans don't get too cocky.
They have to deliver.
They do, and they are. But, you don't want to get too, we can take these guys. Yeah. Don't count on it. Keep doing what you're doing and keep listening. And as Trump does so effectively, show that you keep listening.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, that's about it for our go over to redstate.com. Check out that VIP column from Andrew. But Andrew, we're just about the time where we do the jokes of the week. You got any jokes for me today?
I have one.
Okay.
That a minister was teaching a class, and he was a religious class, and he was talking about vestments that the priests wore, and he asked the class, for instance, why do you think I wear this collar? And there's a kid in the class raised his hand and said, because it protects against fleas and ticks for 30 days. I have that's probably apocryphal, but I have a true story. I had a friend who was a priest, then retired from priesthood and went into teaching and was just a marvelously intelligent man. But when he used to travel, he would sit on the plane and he would wear his collar, and he got so tired of all of his travels, of every time he'd sit down and the person in the next seat would start sharing their troubles and seeking solace, since he was strapped into his seat for the next 2 or 3 hours.
Right, yeah. Captive.
Yeah. And so he started by sitting down, and someone would sit next to him and he would turn to them and say, have you been saved? And he said that kind of shut things down for the flight.
So it worked out
okay.
All right. Well, I got one for you.
Okay.
I think you'll like this. All right. There's three old men and they're sitting around talking, right? The 80-year-old man said, you know, the best thing that could happen to me would just be just have a good pee. I stand up there for 20 minutes and it dribbles and hurts. I have to go over and over again. The 85-year-old man said, you know, the best thing that could happen to me is if I could have one good bowel movement. I take every kind of laxative I can get my hands on, and it's still a problem. And then the 90-year-old man says, you know, I don't have those problems. Every morning at 6 a.m. sharp, I have a good long pee. At around 6:30 a.m., I have a great bowel movement. The best thing that could actually happen to me is if I could wake up before 7.
Hey-o.
Hey-o.
Okay.
And we're all going into that era of our lives. You know, whippersnappers out there. That's a joke, kind of. I want to say.
Yeah.
All right. Andrew Malcolm, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, at AH Malcolm on Twitter, RedState.com, of course, where you can find everything he's writing. Andrew, thank you so much. Great talking with you. We'll talk again next week.
You bet. Thanks, Ed. Thanks, everybody. See you then.